You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stephens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm talking to someone who is a breath of fresh air. He's a comedian I've worked with all over the world, and he's someone who has absolutely survived and escaped the lifestyle of a road act to make a really different, clean living, hard-working life for himself. He's really, really inspiring. He's a very, very funny comic, and he's got a very interesting story to tell. This is the brilliant Mickey D. So, let me see the scar.
Okay.
And so, we'll direct people to a picture of it. And right. We'll start with your scar.
Okay, you ready? I'm just taking the... Oh, God. Good job I didn't buy the...
These are very
the
tight.
The trendy Melbourne jeans. No, I had the option for the trendy Melbourne jeans, but here we go. There we go. Have a look at that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's 10 stitches in all. Well, the stitches are out, and there's some scabbing there. You can refer to the picture. Yeah, mate. It's healed up pretty well, all in all. I've been massaging bio oil into it like it's a cesarean scar.
Oh my God.
Yeah, just to get the scar tissue down so the flexion extension can happen again back in the knee and I can carry on being an armchair athlete.
So you were doing what when this happened? How did you do it?
I was running 5 marathons in 5 days. That was my challenge. It's an annual event up in Lancashire called Hell of a Hill.
Okay.
And I was raising money for charity. That was a side bonus, but it was just a massive task. Day 4, 20 miles into the 4th marathon, and I was feeling stronger. My times were getting faster each day. I've slipped on a rock, slipped on some mud and gone completely into a gang of rocks and just split my knee open.
Oh,
and that was me out. It was strange because I felt a mixture of relief.
Yeah.
Because I went, well, I'll sleep in tomorrow. Don't have to turn out and do it.
So, I don't have to do a marathon tomorrow.
Yeah,
I don't have to finish
on
this
one.
On
the bright side, yeah. And somebody, a passing mountain biker, rang 999, and I didn't know this. After I got stitched back and dropped off at race headquarters, they go, well, here's the footage of your helicopter. They sent a helicopter
what?
To get me. Yeah, and the mountain rescue. We drove past them. The paramedic sorted me out there on site.
Mm.
And they rushed me off to Bolton Hospital to get stitched up. And we passed the mountain rescue on the way there. The sirens are blaring and they've gone, I hope that's not for me. Jokingly, it was.
Oh, my God.
So all in all, about 14 people were scrambled and a helicopter sent for me. Yeah, so the new joke is I milk a round of applause. I raised $2,500 for Christie.
That was going to be my next question.
And on the flip side, the mountain rescue helicopter cost $6,000.
Oh.
So guess who I'm running my marathon for next year?
Oh, mate, that's lovely.
So that's
it's interesting. I like with this show, with this process, I really like to try and get a sense of who my guests are, like a real, who are you? I want to show people who you are to me. And it's funny because just that There's so many avenues we could explore in that initial thing. The fact that we're at my mum's house, uniquely. Never
done
a podcast here before because you live in Birmingham. So we've got all the kind of like where you live in the world. I know you're a big international traveller. We'll get to that in a while as well. Then there's also the fact that because we've moved and we're sorting the stuff, as I was setting up, your instinct was, shall I show you my scar? Which says something about you as a person as well. Then there's the fact that you were running 5 marathons in 5 days, which from that we can get into the fact that you're super sober and clean now. Mm. This was not the case when I met you.
That's right.
But I think what I want to start with is when I... our first gig that we did together. Now, I don't know if you'll remember this. It was a Mirth gig. It was in an aircraft hangar.
Oh, yes.
Do you remember?
Yeah,
I mean,
it wasn't.
It sort of wasn't being used as an aircraft hangar, but it was effectively an aircraft hangar.
Yeah, Hatfield?
Yeah, gee, well done. I mean, that's got to be going on for 7, 8 years ago.
Yeah.
And I remember that the first time I met you, within about 30 seconds of knowing you, you were calling me Goldie. Like, you've done that kind of instant nickname thing. And I've mentioned that to other people, and they're like, oh, yeah, Mick's very like that. Like, you have a quality that I think is so rare and so special, whereby you meet anyone and you're best friends with them within 20 seconds.
Oh, thanks, mate.
Yeah, but, I mean, you're so welcome. You're so welcome. You are just a joy to be around. And it's not simply that you're this kind of, you know, like a nice idiot. Do you know what I mean? It's not like you're just like a happy guy.
Hi, Goldie.
There's some quality that you have, which is, it just means that everyone likes you.
Cheers.
Do you think, do you feel that in life? Do you recognise that in yourself?
Well, there's that thing, everyone wants to be liked. Or, you know, sometimes it might come from a place where you want to be accepted. You know, so it's I feel, well, basically, I went to about 7 to 10 different schools. We moved around a lot as a kid. So
okay.
This is
you army folks, was it?
No, publicans.
Oh, really?
Yeah, hospitality.
Okay,
so,
okay.
Age of 7, dad bought his first pub.
I'm confusing the story. At one point, the pub was on an army base. Is
yeah,
that right?
Very
yes,
nearby.
Gotcha. I thought you were an army kid. Yeah. Okay, gotcha.
Spot on. So, yeah, on a Thursday, I'd see, yeah, that's when we get all the army boys in. So, yeah. So I guess, yeah, I had to work quick on my feet, meet people and get on immediately. So, you know, be new school, new venue, new audience, new colleagues, new schoolmates, new comics. So,
yeah.
You know, I get to, you know, a very short time to, you know, meet people and just carry on because I'll be coming in midterm.
Yeah.
I'll be coming in, you know, halfway into a festival or whatnot. You know, you just have to hit the ground running and just be yourself and back yourself in.
You see that when you come out on stage. I was watching a couple of your YouTube videos. Of course, we worked together in New Zealand before as well.
Good
and
times.
Australia.
Yeah.
And when you come out on stage, you instantly win a room over, I think, from the videos I was watching this morning and from the stuff what I've seen you before. One of the things, there's a sort of a technical thing you do, which is that you're one of those people who has insider information on every place.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
There's a video of you doing the New Zealand Comedy Festival, and you do think it's Christmas, and you go, oh, it's a time of Christmas cheer, and it's also a time of cheer, and you're, like, you're into like it. But like that is a thing, you know, you only get the word cheer if you go to New Zealand a few times and know what that means. So presumably, are you kind of constantly pumping people for information everywhere you go?
Yeah, that's the thing. I being part of the Melbourne Comedy Festival Roadshow was like a big honour, and it's exactly that. You get asked to do that. I was brought onto it as a teenager. How old was I? Just turned 18, and the things you go to town, always got to get a bit of local, and I'd also ask, a cheeky thing, I was a little bit of a wheeler and dealer, so I'd ask
we could assume from that what we may.
Yeah, so I'd ask the tour manager, look, have we got any, how many free tickets can we give away? So I go up and down the high street of, let's just say Bunbury springs to mind, Bunbury, West Australia. I was up and down the street as a 18, 19-year-old going into surf shops going, look, do you want a couple of free tickets to the show tonight? Because those surf shorts look quite nice. I was trying to and then get it. If the guy goes, yeah, bonus, some cheap surf shorts, Or he says, no, here's a bit of a band. He goes, you're a bit of a chance. I go, yeah, I'm just doing the show. And then get a bit of back and forth about the town. Much like, you'd see, the barman talking to his regulars. I watch my dad and watch our staff. It's a staff. We have staff. Had the other barman, I grew up in a pub, just seeing how people would communicate and talk back and forth in that kind of environment. So, yeah, you get the intel on the town and try and work out what makes certain parts of the world tick and then, hit the ground running.
So did you get on with your folks?
Yeah.
Yeah. And are they still alive now?
Mum and Dad in Adelaide.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dad's still, they're still working in hospitality. Our mum's now, she's working in a hospital. She's working in the kitchen there. Still very much in contact with people every day and, very, very giving folk and hardworking.
It's hard to imagine you doing anything other than stand-up
comedy. Yeah, I like to say I've revisited some old material about, because people ask me, you get it a lot, So you do... This is what you do, and you try not to be cocky. It's like, 15 years, professional, 2001, 2002 is when, basically I say now, Colonel Sanders couldn't tame this wild horse, because that was my only other job. Well, I did half my Bachelor of Education, majoring in sports science, so that was like, I really love applied science where I can put it into something I can see, so training, my running and all that, but... Bachelor of Education, left that halfway through because I got the big offer from Melbourne Comedy Festival Roadshow and some telework in my second year. It all happened really quick in Australia, and then I moved overseas to tackle the UK.
Did you do Raw and all that kind of
process? Yeah, I won South Raw, Australian final of Raw, and then in the grand final in Melbourne in front of 1,400 people, they awarded their first ever kind of runners-up prize. I come second to Chris Franklin, who now is a lifetime... Oh, he's like a big brother, really, everyone knows Chris Franklin in Australia and wider
afield. I have to say, I don't know Chris Franklin.
Oh, he's amazing. He's kind of like the big brother you're glad you have. And, he's just so warm, open, and generous. He's just an amazing bloke. And everyone I met in that year in Raw, we're still in contact, a good portion of us anyhow. I was working at KFC and working out the back of house with all the trolls, I say, because once you're out the back, you're stuck out the back because you're getting burnt and cut and bruised the whole time.
They don't put you on show.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then what did I do? I come out to Edinburgh 2000, August 9th, I landed in Edinburgh. Festival was already underway. My thing was get to the Gilded Balloon, go and meet Adam Hills. Because Adam Hills was, he emceed my first ever gig in Adelaide.
Okay.
So went there to do my first recce. Mary Tobin put me in contact with Karen Corrin.
Yeah.
Who gave me my first ever paid gig in Edinburgh. And I was on with Ross Noble and what's the other bloke's name? Oh, Russell Brand. So that was my first ever gig in the UK. What happened to him?
Yeah. What kind of profile were they at the time? Obviously, they're massive now.
Ross was selling really well in the main room, old Wilkie House, where original Late and Live was. Yes, Ross was selling out there. I think he was Chicken Man, the name of his show. He had a massive – people were already making big wooden sets for him. So he was at a pretty big level. Okay. Then old Rusty Rockets was he was doing the MTV stuff. He's a bit of a wild man. So he was – I remember him standing on a chair and just berating a heckler. And the show was called Festival Fiver Fever because somebody cancelled the time slot before Late and Live. So that was – I remember getting the phone call from Karen and then going to ring Dad internationally on a payphone. I've gone in and I bumped into this Edinburgh trampy. We're kind of going on the phone box the same time. He's going, oh, no worries, big man. I'm just going in there for a push. And then I made the phone call and I've gone, yes, I've got my first paid gig. It's all going to click together. Then come September, I had to get a job in Edinburgh at KFC. So I ended up working at KFC.
So you stayed?
Applied skills. My Aussie experience at KFC, I thought, well, I should have got a job at a pub. I was offered a job at the Odeon for the other people I was living at the hostel, but I worked at KFC again, and I worked my ass off there to save up to go to New York where I had gigs booked in.
Okay.
Because I've met so many contacts that year doing Edinburgh and Adelaide. I was I just turned 21 by the time I was going out to the States. And I told them, I said, when I handed them, I said, look, I'm giving my 2 weeks' notice. Why are you quitting? I'm like, oh, because I'm going to New York. What for? And I said, well, I'm going out there to do gigs. I'm a stand-up comedian. What? But you're not funny,
yeah.
Right? Because I never told them I was a stand-up. I just put my head down and worked and worked and worked. So other than KFC and Bachelor of Education and a paper round and working in a recycling centre, yeah. I'm a career comic from age 18.
And you're, I mean, you mentioned Russell Brand being a wild man at the time. Mm. I mean, you, it's interesting. There's a really fascinating sort of duality in who you are, because I was just thinking, anyone listening to this who hasn't seen you for 10 years would be like, who's this guy? Who's this calm, measured, healthy version of Mickey who runs 5 marathons? Because at the time, I think when I met you, you and visible, strikingly visible on your YouTube videos, there's a hell of a belly there.
Oh, yeah.
Because you were a big drinker and a smoker and everything. You really kind of went for it. So where did that come from? Were you doing that before the KFC kind of era, before the Edinburgh era?
No, see, I was still pretty clean living then. Look, I dabbled. Like, I had some great... some great time. Adelaide loves a smoke. It's decriminalised. So I wouldn't say I smoked a hell of a lot of weed back then. But as far as dabbling and as far as recreational drugs, that was part of the diet.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, whatever I've always done, I've never done it by halves. Ironically, tablets. Yeah, I'd always do them by halves, but yeah. I do a lot of them.
But even calling them tablets, it just sounds cute. I feel like I could play my granny this.
Yeah, like, come on, a couple of tablets, or pingers, or googs, or, whatever you want to call. We go out pretty hard, but that was the thing. I remember saying, I did this lovely gig the other night up in Lancashire, kind of a family pub where I feel so at home at these little pub gigs, and I stop and reflect, and always, because you see the gaffer looking over his bar at a full house, and I've gone, this is really nice. And I said to this young lad in the front row, I said, if I give you some advice on drugs, young man, is I won't lie, they're incredible. And you see his mum going, what are you doing? I go, no, it's all right. They're honestly incredible, and that's the problem, that because they're better than everything. And but you're go and try and see if I'm not wrong. And you see his mum just shaking her head. But then I thought, look, but honestly, they're better. You're here with your family. You're on a night out with your family, and that's what I wish I could go and reclaim. The time I wasn't completely genuine and. Myself, I got lost up in it all, and I couldn't be the father I am, the husband I am now, if I was still doing that kind of stuff, I gave the powders and the whiskey a good nudge, in my latter years in London, and it just wasn't agreeing with me anymore. The problem was, I'd absolutely rip a gig, and people would say that was amazing. And I'd come off thinking, I did, I crushed that. And then I'll probably be able to pull off the next night as well, going, I've got this sussed, and then it's trying to recapture that. So I didn't have any consistency. I'd be, every now and then I'd pull a blinder off because there's the right blend of bravado, fearlessness, and, I was untouchable as far as I put that.
And would you be working on drugs or drunk?
Yeah.
Or is that like a celebratory thing after the gig?
No.
You were going on stage hammered?
You know what? It'd be, I'd be in a state from celebrating afterwards. I'd still be in that place the next day, and I'd just kind of top myself up so I could be in that kind of measured form for the next night. Gotcha. I'd never eat a whole lot of drugs. I'd never go out of my way to be trashed before a gig. It just would be where I already was.
Yes,
if that makes sense.
Yes, yeah, I do, and I feel like I remember you from that period. I remember a sort of a.
Mm.
That's a thing that's easy to do with comedy, isn't it?
If you find
that you can work as well, or I'm sure for some people better. If you're just like coasting slightly, if you're just a bit inebriated or a bit drugged up or whatever it is.
But like anything in life, that just that wedge gets thicker.
Yes.
And I remember, I can't remember, well, just again, a good staff at the sit down comedy club. I got cut off before I went on, and this was my third night there, and right. I'd ripped.
This is Brisbane.
Fidelity, great man, books great acts. The whole sit down crew, Rog and everyone, they really look after you. And so I'm back there, and it was, you know, I'd watch the show, and I'd always make a point if I'm headlining to watch the whole show, because you want to see what's happened, you want to see what the crowd could do with, and what to bounce off. So I've watched the whole show, and I would have had, and this was standard. And it took my wife to point this out to me. She goes, so you mean before you go to work, which is what you do, it's your passion, it's your career, you're just in hanging around. For example, on this night I would have had 1, 2, 4 pints and then maybe a couple of shots of Jaeger, because Jaeger was the rage at the time. So I've had 4 pints, 2 litres of, you know, of 4X Castle Mate, only the finest people, and 2 shots of Jägermeister, and then it's the bracket before I'm about to go on. So the MC's about to bring me on, and I said to the lady behind the bar, can I have another pint, please, and 2 shots of Jäger? Because that's what I wanted to have before I went on. And that was just, I was thinking, that's normal. And she's gone, nah, I'm sorry, you've had enough. And here I'm thinking, she mustn't remember me from the night before. I'm going, but hang on, I'm not a punter.
Yeah.
But she was doing me a favour, you know. So I've actually gone, this is where I was in my head. I've gone, look, sorry, not being funny, but can you get your boss?
Yeah.
So I just said, look, can I just get my drinks because I'm about to go on? I didn't think that she was doing her job properly, which is responsible service to alcohol. Technically, I wasn't paying for it.
So, you're right.
But, you know, so it was getting out to that stage, and it was like, and my wife, Boo, amazing woman, to give me so much more strength and clarity through just pointing out stuff like, so you mean you'd, before, like a festival show, I'm on at 8 o'clock. During festivals are awesome, meet up with all your best mates from around the world, and we're having a barbie in the backyard playing some backyard cricket. It's just heaven for an Aussie. So I've had four bottles of beer. Get to the venue, I'm doing a gig before my show, do a guest spot, have a pint there, and then go out to my gig, I buy a cider for me and a cider for my sound guy because he's a good bloke. And that's before I go to work. And then after the show, I'll have a couple of drinks with the punters, and that's just socialising, and then I'd make the decision to go out drinking.
Yeah, right.
You know, I wasn't.
Jesus.
You know, that was just life. That's how it became.
Yes.
So and then you go, right, well, all right, I'm not progressing. I'm not getting better. I'm getting deeper depressions. I'm unfit. I'm unhealthy because I've always quite a competitive sportsman in high school. I played high level cricket and captain the Australian rules footy team at my college.
Mm-hmm.
And so then to take, so I wasn't firing on all cylinders, but I still had that kind of competitive streak in me, and I was taking that to work with me now. I was taking that on stage and, like, getting angry and jaded about other people's progression.
Okay.
Like, and they were progressing because they'd been solid and consistent and they deserved it. And I'm like going, well, on my best day, I'm better than all these people, which is not how the game works.
Yes,
of course. How sport works. It's how competitive full contact. That is a
really interesting analogy. Yes, you know? It is.
And that's where I was in my head.
Provided you do the best one ever once, everyone remembers it, but that's not how comedy works.
No, because it's a team game where everyone needs to win for the greater good of the audience.
Yes. You know. And not just on the night, but on the run, the whole run of shows. Yeah, okay.
So, I got a bit lost there for a bit, and I definitely rattled a few, rattled a few cages in Melbourne, and it's regrettable, but, you know, you've just got to be the best you can.
Did the drinking come from a place of unhappiness? You mentioned depression there. I mean, it sort of sounds like, you know, it was just that you were a kind of party, good time guy that was everyone's friend. Everyone bought you drinks, and that's how you slipped into it. Or was there something that you were running away from or to?
Interesting. A bit of both. More the former.
Yeah.
Like, I'd have to say that, you know, it was the happy-go-lucky guy wants to just. I definitely wanted to be the last to leave the party, so no one could talk about me because I would be quite loose. You know, so I'd always make the... There's always a point of pride to be the last man standing. So that was...
So no one could talk about you?
You know, is that the whole thing? Yeah, because you don't want to leave and then have them go, oh, God. So you wanted to be present for the whole time.
So I'm not familiar with the word loose in the context that
you used as in... yeah, because I'd be not hammered, but I'd be pretty... Yeah, I'd be pretty wrecked at a party. And you just make sure... Like, for example, after festivals... We go back to Craig Egan's house. Craig Egan, one of my best mates ever, best man at my wedding. He'd host some amazing parties after, you know, the Rhino Room would cool down and we'd go out hard at parties there. And I'd just make sure, you know, I'd be a mess, but I'd still make a point of staying up and making sure I saw out the night so no one could talk about me.
That's very unusual. That, okay. That was a real insight into that how your head was working.
Yeah,
at the time.
Like because it got to a place where I was unhappy.
Yeah,
you know, and it was I don't think I was trying to replace anything. I just lost control because I definitely have that kind of thing about me. Is I want to do whatever I'm doing to its greatest capacity or potential. But the thing is. And what I've taught myself recently is that's the one thing you can't succeed in. You can push yourself hard as you can in that down that road, and you can excuse it for what you think it is. You know, I'm telling myself, oh, I'm trying to do the Gonzo thing, and that was my process.
Yes,
I was trying to say this. I'm gonna send myself on a journey tonight, and because strangely, a lot of these nights where I blow myself up and go out, I'd be able to recall it all. I've got a pretty like Hatfield. I remember the gig. I could tell you about that gig. Jeff Norcott was on the same night.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And we developed a nickname for. I think I was pretty drunk that night, and it was a tough gig. There was a long table, about 14 people.
Yeah.
And there was a lady. It was a Christmas show, and there was a lady about four back on this front table, and the whole table ended up disappearing because she just kept heckling and heckling.
Oh my God! I remember that. Right. Yeah. There is no way I'd have been able to recall that without you.
Yes, and I was very drunk that night too. In Norcott, so I can remember all this stuff.
Yes.
And Jeff's one of my best mates, and he calls the term Kermiting, because this is where the nickname, he called me Kermit for a bit, because what I did is I sat on the bar and I thought, I just moved as far as away from her because I was on a cordless. So I sat on the bar and she goes, oh, he's done a Kermit.
Yes. So oh, my God.
I was Kermiting that night. So I can remember all this stuff when I was thinking. So that was I might have been hiding a drink and drug problem in the fact that, I'm going out to you know, human theatre, I'd call it. I'd go and try and push some boundaries and see what I can report back.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of doing the graft and sitting down writing gags, I'd go out and live an experience. And retell.
So this is Mickey. I hope you're enjoying this. I just love spending time with him. I'm sure you can hear in the warmth of my voice how much I'm enjoying this one, which now I think of it is to say nothing of next week's episode when I'll be interviewing enfant terrible of the British comedy circuit, Alfie Brown. And I think at one point during the show, I professed my love to him. It didn't go quite that far with Mickey, but as you can hear, he's a lovely guy. We're getting some really good life experience stuff, actually. One of the key ways that Mickey interests me is how he manages to be so busy, so globetrotting, so happy, and be an effective husband and father and run marathons. And as you can hear through the interview, I'm very, very excited by that. And I hope he fields lots of offers for professional coaching jobs from all of you to get everyone up and running. And on the subject of benevolent things, I got an email from Simon Kane, who's tried to do, he said, I've decided to try and use the circuit in a positive way by asking every comedian to donate £1 to shelter. I know your audience, he says, has a lot of comedy fans and performers in it. So you can go to the link on the Comedians Collective Facebook group. I think that's an invite only group, you need to be confirmed for it somehow. So that's a sort of an internal comedy industry initiative. But if you'd like to donate a pound or more, he says he's already nosing up to £1,000, which is fills me with hope, really, that we can all look past all of our horrendous Christmas gigs and try and turn some of those wages into something positive. Remember to go and see Slightly Fat Features. These are my old street performing buddies, and some of them are old. Some of them are, well, one of them in particular, lovely little old timer. But go and see them. They're a wonderful, wonderful gang show called Variety Soup, which is happening at the Leicester Square Theatre. I saw it last night and it just makes me howl with laughter. It's suitable for children, it's fun for all the family, and it's a lovely, warm, different thing. If you've if you've spent your whole year seeing stand-up, then go and see some old-school variety nonsense by a bunch of seven increasingly elderly men who should know better. I myself am going to be at the World Buskers Festival in Christchurch in January, just around the corner. I think I'm travelling out there in just less than a month. I'm very excited about that. So if you're going to be in New Zealand during January and you're on the South Island, come along to Christchurch and say hello. I'm comparing the stand-up stage every night with Chris Turner, Harley Breen and the absolutely brilliant Luke Heggie. So I'm really looking forward to that, and that's going to be my big writing during the day. I'm totally going to write for like 5 or 6 or 7 hours every day and then gig every night. That's definitely what I'm going to do. I definitely am going to do that, because at the moment the next year's Edinburgh show is just feeling like a big amorphous blob with one joke in it about coffee. So that's where we are with that. You can donate to the show, of course, at comedianscomedian.com. If you would like to support this podcast, you can make a donation of any amount of money. We respectfully suggest £10, £20 or £1 a show if you're feeling flush. Click on the extremely visible PayPal button at comedianscomedian.com. You can also, if you are a Patreon user, you can patronise me at patreon.com/comcompod, and you make a regular dollar donation. Apparently it's all in dollars still, you make a regular donation there, and every time a show comes out I get a little thing from it. Apparently I don't think they've sent me any money yet, but a few people have signed up to that. Let's see what happens. And finally, if you'd like to send this is cheeky, but you'll understand why this is fun. I've recently been using the Amazon locker at Shepherd's Bush Library, because now listen, there's an ethical issue here. Every time I mention Amazon, my more right-on friends go, oh no, Amazon are bastards. And I'd be totally honest with you, I haven't looked into why. If it turns out that they are bastards, it's probably tax and workers' conditions and stuff like that, then I will try not to use them. I don't know. Can anyone not use Amazon these days? Is there a way of shopping that doesn't involve doing it in 20 seconds online? Oh, maybe I shouldn't be... I feel like I'm advertising them now, which was never my intention. All I was going to say was, I've discovered this locker thing where you can get stuff sent directly to the locker, and then they email you a code, and you go along and you punch the code in, and a little door in the locker pings open, and you feel like a spy, and you pick up a package. And as if that wasn't good enough, each locker all over the country has got a different name, and the one near me is called Cronus, K-R-O-N-U-S, Cronus. And so I've been popping in to see Cronus and pick up little packages I've been getting for Christmas sort of every other day. And the best bit is that just next to Cronus is an automated library book checking out machine that looks very similar to TARS from Interstellar. So look, I throw myself on your mercy, people who consider that Amazon is a terrible thing. I will look into it in the new year, I promise. But for the moment, I'm just going to let myself enjoy Cronus over the Christmas period. And then next year, I will approach it with fresh eyes and do my research properly. So if you would like to send something to the podcast, no matter how small, send me a sprout, wrap it nicely. So, oh Christ, don't send me a sprout. Maybe we should just bail this whole bit. But if you fancy sending anything to the podcast, it just occurred to me, you could send me, I don't know, a fucking turd in a box or something. Send it to Cronus, K-R-O-N-U-S, and email me the code, and I'll go along and I get a little surprise thing. Maybe now you're going to all ironically send me documents about how terrible Amazon are. I'm prepared to accept that maybe they're terrible. I think we all exist in a world in which it's just we try not to think about how awful everything is, because if you think about it too hard, you realise seven companies own everything. So this Christmas, I am receiving things from my Amazon locker just because there's a robot. I go in and I bow to the little robot that I call TARS. Did anyone else see Interstellar and want TARS to be sort of their dad? He's such a good robot. Will we leave this bit in? Let's leave it in for now and see what happens. Don't send me a sprout. Don't stink up Cronus. Send me something non-organic. And if you fancy, you know, rather than a donation, why not a bit of Lego or something, anything like that. There we go. That's all of that. Now let's get back to the very lovely Mickey D.
Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Did it come to a head at some point? Was there some awful experience where you went, that's it forever?
Several rock bottoms. And that's right, the thing. But, okay. You know, but you need good support and, you know, something solid, like, you know, like a proper purpose, you know.
Yeah.
My own family. I've got a wife and a child. I can't let them down. I've got to be the best me I can. And, yeah. You know, there was other times. I had the gambling come into it as well.
Okay.
So that was the thing. I go out and because of all the kind of Bibles to have, Fear and Loathing, the book, and then the movie enthralled me in my early 20s. It was never going to end well because I sat down and learned all about it and watched it with Greg Fleet of all people.
Yes. Okay.
The master, you know, and you know, they had another one of your big brothers is Greg Fleet, and it was amazing. Sit down, and he introduced me to Hunter S. Thompson.
Yes. And that must have confirmed all of your thoughts about this is how I'm going to do it.
There's two masters right there.
Yes.
So I've gone, okay, that's how I'm going to report. So I go and, you know, turn both taps on hard and live life like that. So, and then gambling runs thick in my Irish blood.
Oh, mate.
So.
As you recount these stories, both on stage and right now, there is a kind of twinkle in your eye.
Oh, yeah.
Do you regret that stuff?
Not one bit.
Or do you think, Christ, I was lucky to get out of it?
Not one bit. A bit of both. Honestly, I was driving down the motorway the other night and I was late for a gig and on a Friday night. I love gigging in the UK for so many reasons, but especially if you pull a double on a Friday night and you're driving between gigs, there's already the adrenaline from the first gig.
Yeah.
And then Pete Tong is on Radio 1, so I'm getting this whole residual kickback and I'm going, oh, man, that was some good times, you know. And, there's no real regrets because I wouldn't be me without that to reflect on.
Yes.
But, you know, I hurt some people in the process and I'm sorry for that, but not massively, but...
Massively sorry.
Yeah, well, a bit of both, you know. Everything happens for a reason. But, you know, I had some great times and I look back on it and like I said, I said to that kid in the audience, I said, they're awesome and that's the problem. You know, and
I think you were really lucky to have come out of them. It's quite an unusual story to have gone so hard and then to have gone so far the other way. It makes me think of someone like Marcus Brigstocke, who just has an addictive personality, really overdid it as a teenager, and now is addicted to life and knowledge and experiences and climbing and ice climbing and, you know, whatever else he
does. Great, I should get his number.
Yeah, you totally should. Yeah, you should hang out. So in terms of you, like, how does your writing process work now? Given that you seem to be someone who writes on stage, who has experiences, who remembers them. Oh, that's what I was going to say, was you were very lucky, I guess, to have had the stamina to not have killed yourself by overdoing it and to have the recall that enables you. I mean, I've had some great nights out. I just can't remember them. You know, whenever I've gone too hard, and it's increasingly a problem now as I approach my 40s, I can't remember any of that stuff, but you can.
Yeah.
So when you're writing, do you mostly write on stage? Do you improvise? Because you've got this kind of really casual sort of Kermiting. Oh, that's a wonderful phrase.
Yeah.
You know, you can grab a mic more so than most other comics I could mention. And I could just say to you, you're not allowed to tell any stories that you've ever told on stage before. And you go, okay, I'll tell these other 100.
Yeah. Oh, I'm lucky in the sense, you're right, I can recall a lot of things and I've been blessed to go so many wild and wonderful places and the places I couldn't go to. I took myself there through other means, you know, so I can pull that from my head. But as far as the process goes, it would be some grafting, get stuff in the notebook, but just write triggers. Like a dot point set list. But I lost my notebook, so I'd thought the other night, mm-hmm. Between gigs, I was rushing between gigs, and I thought, I've left the notebook on the roof of the car. And I'm like, oh, you dig. And then I've gone, okay, I could probably drive back there after my second gig and get it, but what if it's gone? And then in the process of, you know, it's a 15-mile drive, I decided, it's like, okay, well, think of the major points that are in your notebook that you haven't taken on stage yet. And just remembered all those. And then that whole thing, you've obviously, like most people, lost a whole heap of work through a computer crash.
Yeah.
And then when you rewrite that essay or whatever it was fresh in your head and it come out better. So I'd convince myself that, okay, well, you're just going to have to suck it up and do that. And I was a little bit disappointed when I found my notebook. And I've gone, so still those shitty little cobweb notes. I've got to, and it's funny because I'm not too proud. I've got to share this with you. It's a bit cheeky, but back in, would have been 2000, a very close mate of mine, Justin Hamilton,
yes,
and myself, we were the alien heads opening Ross Noble's show for him. He had these dancing aliens that would sing along, and then Ross Noble would come out.
Okay.
And we cheekily had a peek. He left his notebook open backstage and just saw how he'd do all these mind maps.
Ross was on the show about 3 weeks ago.
I promise I didn't flick any pages. I just looked. I went, wow. So I've used stuff like mind maps and how just like a central word and like drawing lines off that to what it else it could trigger, just to kind of know where at any point it's like a linear nature of a set where you could draw on anything and use a story to back up a point. But then coming into that problem is the amount of stage time. I used to run over quite a bit, which was quite naughty. So it's about I've done better work when I've been more regimented and, okay, just hit these out, get on, get off.
Yeah.
Leave them wanting more.
Yeah. And so is that process by which you write your kind of bullet points and then presumably are you doing Edinburgh this year? Are you making a new show?
A new show for Adelaide and Perth and Adelaide.
Yeah, sorry, it's a very UK-centric way of describing it.
I will be in Edinburgh, but I hope to take this show there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so when you sit, where does that show begin? I sort of get the, for me, I go, right, day one, I'm going to start writing now. I sort of get the impression for you that the stuff is constantly turning over and turning up in bits and bobs and gigs. I've got that.
And I'm not too proud to say, I might pull some old stuff from 7 years ago in, rework that in a new context. Like, I think I'm going to put some KFC stuff back into the new show.
Yeah.
Because there's an acronym that they used to drum into us called CHAMPS. Like, I'm trying to, I'm doing my very best. I want to become a champion athlete. That's where I want to push myself. That's where I want to go. So, but linking to that is what they used to drum into us at KFC, which is you're a champ. Cleanliness, hospitality, accuracy, maintenance, product, speed. And I'll never forget that. Even if I didn't have a good memory, it'd just be drummed into us. So stuff like that would be coming in. And, it's, like you said, it's a constantly evolving process, working stuff in. But I think, first of all, I'd sit down and do what I hear Tarantino does. Like, before he puts together a film, he goes, okay, what kind of music would I like to listen to as I'm building this film? I've heard that's how he operates. Okay. So I kind of put together a bit of a playlist on my iTunes of how am I feeling, what kind of music have I been listening to in the last year as I've been thinking about making this show.
Okay.
And that kind of becomes a soundtrack in my head, and that's where I'm at emotionally. That's
brilliant. I've never heard of that.
So so there's certain songs because I was saying before, how driving down the motorway listening to Pete Tong. So I'm listening to a lot of old house music. My daughter, she's turning four, she's into her house music. So there's that running through me. There's some tunes that that get me, take me into a place I don't think I'll be putting these songs in my show, but they're a part of building it. I'll go into.
So do you listen to that same playlist over and over again while you write, or is it just that you're Just talk to me a bit more about exactly how that works. That's fascinating. That's okay. A brilliant idea. So are you sort of saying you put them in order and then you write stuff that suits each song? So you end up with a...
Well, you're not to really shape the show, but just to kind of get the tone. So this is where... I want to write the show to... Usually I'd go, in the past I've written the show, to go hard and fast and just keep hitting them hard and fast, yeah. And then slow it down at 45. It's that old classic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Slow it down at 45 and then try and tie it all off.
Yeah.
But this year's show's quite different. I'm essentially, I wouldn't say battling myself. I'm going out there playing an over-enthusiastic kind of guy giving a motivational talk. So, okay. And then I'm hijacking it as me as a stand-up kind of... So I'm hijacking my own TED talk.
Okay.
About, you know, it's called a masterclass of champions. So it's tongue in cheek.
Okay.
It's like, you know, it's basically the way you don't never want to go about emceeing. No one wants a show rammed down their throat on a Friday. I've made the mistake so many times, coming out going, yeah, you're up for a big night. It's like, dickhead, they're here.
Yeah.
Just welcome them and don't rattle them up. It's like, why aren't you cheering with me? It's because they've worked all week, mate.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Just slowly. So I'm going to kind of work in with that kind of vibe. No one wants anything. So I'm going to ram a show down their throat for 10 minutes and then pull myself up on it and then restart it again, then constantly contradict myself throughout the show. So it's a real battle. So it's interesting. Instead of it being, last few shows have been kind of me going out and doing a straight stand-up and kind of tying it off some kind of loose theme, but mm-hmm. this year it's going to be, you know, trying just to push myself with something different, and then I'm going to take my audience for a run afterwards. Because I'm
lovely.
So it's
that's a great idea.
So just something a little bit different.
But. Have you had the reaction that you've wanted for your do you feel your last like shows over the last 15 years? You say have they always got what you felt they deserved, kind of critically and in terms of audience?
Critically, yes. The audience last year, no. Those that came were wonderful, but I got nominated for best show for the third time in Adelaide, and the nights where I had judges in, they stuck out like sore thumbs because they were one of six.
Wow.
And it was
weird. So it wasn't selling in Adelaide, and you're from Adelaide.
It was strange.
And you've got the pedigree.
Midweek, it was just hard. Like some nights were so...
Is the festival itself kind of bloated
now? It's getting bigger, but it's just hard because, you know, it's that combination of people have seen me. I'll be honest, I've turned over some old material and repackaged it again. So they've gone, okay, good on them for going and seeing other stuff. But just midweek was slow, and it just so happens that's when the judges were coming, and it was a... I did this. Yeah, I did this, but it was fun. So I just had to slow the show down. I had to, because you can't ram a high energy show down people's throats. So I learned a lot by just slowing it down, and I stumbled on a new rhythm since being a father because I'm literally exhausted. So trying to train for marathons and be a father and be do the road miles, be a good husband, be supportive, and then try and turn out a high energy set. I just was turning up, and it's kind of like how Jack D stumbled on a rhythm.
Yes.
That he, you know, just kind of not, you know, just turned up and just rolled it out with nothing to lose. And I stumbled on that, and I realized if I realized I could get more for doing less. You'd tell me this 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Or 10 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's like, oh, wow.
It's funny just seeing you today, just when you arrived half an hour ago, you seem to have a different internal rhythm. And I was wondering, what is that, the marathons? Is that maybe it is just being knackered? But maybe the being knackered in the marathons have kind of, like you say, that you've kind of realised, oh, I can be like this.
Yeah.
I can be at this rhythm.
I like referring to it as the stillness. You know, you're assured, you're not in a hurry, because it's that quiet... A quiet confidence, and whether it's whether you front it out to an audience, if they see you do nothing for 20 seconds, they're like, "Wow!" Burnsy said it to me. Brendan Burns said, "People's chief fear of public speaking is going blank or freezing." That's probably where the crux of their fear comes. Or what if they're frozen? So to present that fearlessly, to go up there and say nothing and not be in a not being a fuss, or people go, wow. And like, you might be up there as the comic, you know, fronting that out, but if you are comfortable enough not to say anything up there, that's
just an observation as well. I think your voice has changed. I think the way you speak has changed. Having seen, having just been like, you know, in the last hour before you arrived, watching some of those videos from like 2008, you, I think, were doing a thing that a lot of men do, which is to make yourself, like lots of men, I think, I've heard this, I'm not no student of psychology, but I think men try to make themselves, unconsciously, they try to make themselves sound more manly by placing their voice back in there to sort of sound tougher.
Mm.
And I think the difference in your voice between that clip in 2008 and now would support that theory of you having found a sort of a different rhythm, and actually you're just going, this is just me.
Yeah, yeah, just, if, you know, because deep down, you know, if it came to it and I needed to turn it on, it's there.
Yeah.
But, you know, let's, until that happens, let's just keep ticking over. You know, it's just, yeah, I think just a stillness. It's, I wouldn't say I've found inner peace. I'm not gonna, you know, I'm not gonna open a lavender shop just yet. But yeah, it's nice just to have a quiet confidence, you know.
With your shows, when you embark on a new show, are you, what's the most important thing for you? Are you most interested in getting them all to laugh, or are you most interested in expressing yourself, or is there, what's thing number one? Is it anything for a laugh, or is it?
Yeah, I've been there. Yeah, I've gone, you know, they've paid to, yet again, Boo, my wife has helped point this out, they've paid to come and see a show and laugh. You know, there's so many personal biographical shows. It's like, you know, everyone has a story, everyone has a background, but essentially people are paying to come and see a show.
Mm.
You know, so you got to find in that blend, you want to share something. Autobiographical, do you want to, you know, try and, yeah, that, so the last few have just been like make them laugh, and now it's like, okay, I want to start playing around with that again. So last year I gave a taste of some good uncomfortable silences. Like I'd start the show in negative territory instead of going out there and going, come on, and getting them on board. I'd pull it back to where the start of the show was me sitting in, it was an outdoor venue, so I was sitting in a garden with a floodlight on me, and I was just meditating until the audience kind of twigged it was me. And then it was a really strange, so starting in negative territory. So, and then just coming up and going, yeah, look, we'll start in a minute. It's all right.
Mm.
It's not in a hurry. And they're like, so that's kind of disarming. And from there, and so, yeah, I just want to see, you know, if people are kind enough to give you, you know, their hour and then their attention during that hour, just seeing what we can share.
Do you think there's a risk with the kind of everyman bit of local, you know, you've got material on, you know, Scotland, and I'm sure you've got material on certain different areas of Scotland and the differences between them and stuff like that. Is there a risk that that can come across as too kind of journeyman-like?
Yeah, it's if true. Yeah, if that's if you could, if that was what your show is entirely about, you know. Yeah. But if you're using that as a vehicle to connect, and that's why I've always applied it. So whether, you know, I tailor the start of a show to whatever town I've been in, because I put in the work that day. I just did a show with Damien Callinan that we'd been working up for nearly a decade, where we'd go into a town with no show, and we've got to turn one out in 30 hours, purely about the town, a show about the town for the town. So it's about applying those skills.
How has that been? Tell us about that.
That was great. It was full on, because you come in, we had a camera crew, so it was about, we put together about between 5 to 10 video sketches, or, you know, little vignettes about town.
Yeah, I think so.
It's called Road Trip.
Yes, so yeah, I've seen a bit of that online. Yeah,
it was an intense process and a great experience to work with Damo, but yeah, very, very challenging, as like, because you wouldn't have any time to kind of reflect, because it's always on to the next town, and keep turning out. So I've exercised that muscle to the extreme on that tour. Like, it was, well, we were on for 8 weeks. Damo did like another 4. He's done 12 weeks. So he's a machine about, you know, coming in, and we went about it different ways. Like Damo would go into the Country Women's Association. I'd go to the front bar. I'd go to the skate bar, a skate park. He'd go to the local history museum. And then
was that a contrivance of the show, or did that reflect your own actual
personalities? Again, okay. and then we played that off each other on stage as well. So yeah, it being one of the ways that I build a show is to connect people, whatever means. And then this show that I'm writing, it's simply called Run. So I'm going to tap in, and it's for everyone, but I'm marketing it for midweek, trying to get people. All the runners to come along, and we'll go for a run afterwards. And
That's such a good idea, mate.
Thank you. I hope it works, because I'm just flat out during Adelaide and Perth, and I'm training for the London Marathon. So I thought it's a bit cheeky. So if anyone hears this and wants to come midweek on Wednesdays and Thursdays, that's where I'm doing my speed work. So if you want to race, I need you to set a pace for me.
So this is in Adelaide. Yeah, well, Wednesdays and Thursdays.
Perth for 6 nights, and in Adelaide. Okay. Adelaide, I'm doing a 3-week run. I've got an extra long run at the Rhino, which is an absolute godsend. So the audience, we're going to have a nice leisurely 5K, 3-miler, and then there'll be a surprise along the way once we reach our destination. And then from there, we might have a little kind of a game. Put some free tickets on the line to see who wants to have a race.
Amazing.
Any excuse to kind of I got to train. So
that is such a good idea to put the training into it. One of my favourite memories of Adelaide is seeing you and the fabulous Fred Southern Star going running at midnight.
Yeah, because you've got time. It's about time management.
Yeah,
and it's funny because Fred, one of my oldest and dearest friends, we were there in the clubbing days together, and our phone calls are much similar. Okay, where are we going to meet up? What time? Have you got the gear? It's like, I've just bought it the other day from Nike.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's hilarious, and we get it's the same excitement, it's the same, and pretty much, I don't know if you to analyze our blood chemistry, probably the same amounts of dopamine running through us, and it's something you can progress at and win at. You know, it's just strange, and she's working towards her first marathon this year, and I'm coaching some other people in riding programs. I'm well into it. It's great, because it was the part of me that kind of was left to die. Was the competitive athlete. It's what I had drummed into me always. Growing up as a young kid, all through high school, there was your parents would say, "You're going to play cricket for Australia." It's like, well, that was a little bit lofty. But I played high level in SA as a youngster and played good. Competitive Aussie rules football, but then my mates went on to play good state level football, and I remember a year out of high school weighing 20, I would have put on 3 stone out of high school because I just got on the beer and the late night food after the comedy, and it was like, yeah, it's just a little bit embarrassing, but you get enough laughs and enough excitement in your life to kind of go, all right, well, I'm getting my good feelings in another basket now.
You and Boo, between you, have kind of a little mini empire of doing kids shows, and she's got her shows, she's got her own solo shows, as well as the Double Act Titty Bar Ha Ha, which I've seen many times.
Yeah.
And you've run in previous years, you've run the Fat Cave in Edinburgh and in Adelaide. You between you, have made a kind of a festival life for yourselves.
Yeah.
Now, does that seems to me like something that... Is that something that you're doing along the way towards a loftier goal of stand-up, of becoming like a famous household name stand-up? Or is that some way that you've gone, actually, the ambition is for the empire rather than the individual success?
Yeah, I think, like anyone, I just want to be happy. And to where, obviously, I don't know if I can speak for everyone, but you'd like to be that household name. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that anymore.
Do you think you've given up on that? No, I haven't given up is really negative. No, I've... Is that less important to you now as well?
Less important. It'd be a lovely bonus. But in that, I'd love to, keep my daughter leaves an amazing life, being around all this... all these amazing people, and we go from festival to festival, and we got six productions in Perth, six productions in Adelaide, and we want to keep building on our production house, and from there.
Yes, that's what it's called, a production house, not an empire per se.
Empire gets me excited.
Level 10, empire.
It's like, that'd be pretty sweet. But yeah, the drive into something that's realistic. See, it's such a roll of the dice and a little bit narrow-minded to think my chief goal is to be a household name when, you could create a wider base and a solid, happy life.
Is that a conclusion that you've had to come to because of the circumstances of having a child or the circumstances of not necessarily getting picked for those more prestigious gigs?
Is that a sort of a
reaction to circumstances, or is that something that you've gone into it thinking this is the most sensible thing for me to do?
No, I just think it's reality. What's life about? It's about being happy and living good quality moments, and it's about where can you combine your free time with your family and work in an environment you remain passionate in, So it's about combining all those things, to pursue the... It's a highly focused path to be putting all your eggs in one basket, to be driving must... it can be done. You work out a plan, and like anything, if you want it hard enough, you set out a plan and goals, and step by step you go, and it's like training from a 5K to a 10K to a marathon to an ultra marathon. Anyone can do it. And I'm laughing out loud there.
Yeah. As listeners to the show will know, I've been coughing up my lungs for the last 2 months. I don't think I could do it. I'd love you to chat about training.
I could have you doing a 10K for New Year's Day. But it's about where am I, where do I want to be in 10 years? I just want to be healthy and happy. And it's by no means kind of giving up or what's compromising. No, it's about reality, and if I remain consistent, and if I'm continue having great gigs, I'm in pretty good form at the moment. I'm having great gigs. I'm having good fun on stage. I'm being real. I'm being myself. And if someone wants to throw massive money at that, and bonus, but I'm a happy guy.
So with your, there's two more things I want to ask you about, really. One is that we'll just cover this very quickly. I see certain festival power couples. I think of the Willses. Yeah. I think of you guys, who have got lots of interests in festivals. You've both got kids, those two examples. Is it possible to continue once your daughter goes to school? Is it possible for you to continue this globe-trotting lifestyle in the way that you're doing it now?
It's tricky. Tom and Trudy Stade took their two lovely kids out of school to come and do an Aussie festival. So it's a little disrupting for the young'uns when they're developing friends. But little bits here and there can work, but it is tricky. We're going to have to make a decision, what's where the more important festivals are or where we do our most work. So it's just something we'll have to come to when it's there, But as far as people go, how do you do it? How do you take? You stick together and you work as a team. And Grace knows no different, the Moog. She comes around. She loves getting on planes. She loves coming out. And she's got so many different uncles like yourself and different, Gordon Southern and Fred Southern are her godparents. Elise Tobin is one of her fairy godmother. She's got three fairy godmothers.
That's perfect for Elise.
Three fairy godmothers and Gordon Southern. Gordy is her godfather. Gordy the godfather. He signed a Christmas card like that. So, she's got a massive wider family and a richness, So we're really, really proud that we can, you know, remain passionate about what we're doing, working in our field and giving that kind of life to our little ones, you know, and yeah. Bring on number two and three, I say.
Excellent.
You know, because we're seeing big money in circus.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
So lastly then, you're given the added responsibility of being a dad who's moving their family around and moving around with their family. It's not obviously your decision. But I mean it's not your decision alone, obviously. But when your shows have so much more riding on them. This is what I'm particularly kind of fascinated with at the moment. My last show was all about how I'm desperate to have a kid. We're not pregnant yet. You know, there's an ongoing conversation about, yeah, maybe we should shut up and have a kid. And that conversation is predominantly motivated by me. But
it's awesome.
I'm very excited about it. But one of my fears, obviously, is, I'm living the inordinately selfish life of a stand-up. How can I look after someone through my work, you know, in terms of making enough money, having enough time?
Yeah.
And I suppose those are all things that we've kind of covered a little bit. But ultimately, I suppose what I'm scared of is that the fear of being on stage at a gig that isn't going well or new material that isn't working.
Yeah,
or,
right.
You know, when you're facing the cliff face of, how do I turn this gig around? How do I write this new show? How do I write this new joke today? And what's riding on it is not just whether or not I'm in a good mood tonight, but actually a longer process of a wider system of the well-being of your family.
Yeah, it's a great healthy pressure. You know, it's like to know that's it's not do or die, really. It's this is your pleasure, your passion, your profession, and it's what you do, and to have your family and your well-being riding on your passion, it's the perfect coupling, you know. It's like and when the odds are stacked against you, that's when you got to play your hardest and your best. So that's where the competitive nature in me is focused now. It's not to be better than anyone else. It's to be better than every scenario that I'm in. Whatever's thrown at me, I've just got to better it. You know, it's a tough gig. Well, you just see it through. It's 6 hour round trip tonight on a, you know, congested motorway. Well, it's just what you do. It's life. You've got four gigs in one day during a festival. Hey, when you're going to get some sleep, you've got to get and pick up your daughter. It's just what you do. And you're just surrounded in a richness, you know, or I could be back a house breading chicken. You know, it's like, I'm a pretty lucky bloke. When we went on a holiday this year, and we're not fancy people, but we bought a package holiday, and we looked at it. We've gone, what are we doing? We've been paid to stay in nicer places. Yeah. we're really lucky people, and to say stuff like that, it sounds a little bit snooty. But
from the point of view of a comic, you get flown to wherever it is, Singapore or Hong Kong, to, you know, somewhere exotic and exciting.
Even with that scenario, you go, well, this is a learning experience, and this is going to be, you know, now, you know, Boo, she's a great comedian as well, and she's like, I'm a fan of me. I've been to all his gigs. So we're looking at this place in Tenerife. That should have been the alarm bells already. We're going to Tenerife for a little holiday, but it was a holiday is the reverse of the norm. We did something completely different. We did something that was organized and streamlined. We love planning and putting together festivals and shows and our holidays as well. So we went and did this package holiday, and then we saw the room, looked completely different to the photos, and just went, oh God, we're here for a week. And then we look at each other going, well, who's gonna get the material? Are you going to put this in your set? Am I going to put this in mine? Are you going to make a song about this? Am I going to rant about it in some story?
Yeah.
So it's to have your love and your partner work in the same field as you, and it's good, man.
I know I said we finished. I promise this is my last question.
Yeah.
I just wanted to talk about my favourite bit of your material, which you were doing in New Zealand 2 years ago.
Okay.
Was about Boo.
Right.
And it was about her putting diesel in the car.
Oh, yeah.
That is such an incredible bit of material. And I just wanted, because we've talked a lot, I suppose the story of Mickey D at the moment that I'm getting, that I've been relishing through this interview, is you turning your life around and just, you know, being the marathon runner that's been inside you the whole time. And that's the thing people always say about comedy, isn't it? It's a marathon, not a sprint.
Yeah.
And you've got you just feel like, oh, this is the right rhythm now. Mick can do this for another 40 years.
Or whatever. Come on. Yeah.
But so we've focused a lot on that and less so on the writing. But I just wanted to choose just that bit of material, specifically that story, and just ask you, did you just tell that story straight on stage, and then do you go and edit it afterwards, or do you improvise it fresh every night? Or is there ever a period where you go, okay, that story works, now I'm going to sit down and
write it? No, that's that one that evolved on stage.
It all involves on stage.
And then plugins. I said that quite nice. Like, it's a big risk to say, I was just about to punch you in the head. If you ever wrote that down in a notebook,
yeah, it's
awful.
It sounds
awful. It's not a good marriage. No. So it's like, yeah, it's constantly, how do I feel about, yeah, it's drawing on feelings of what, when I found out. It was like a horrible moment when she made the mistake. So it's not a happy story. So it's been celebrating that everyone makes mistakes, and in doing so, yeah, and that I'm still enjoying doing that bit 2 years on, and it's evolved yet again.
It's a great,
and
it is
good. And then to see how different audience members react, and to see, you know, because I'm not no one wants to hear a throwaway joke about threatening to hit your wife, of course, you know what I mean. But and then the follow up is like,
I feel I've got to preface this with a warning now on the podcast, but that is not really what the story is about.
No,
and it's beautifully handled, and it's like we're doing it because this is the only specific bit of material we've talked about. I feel like this is
I'm
like
a nice guy.
The dark secret at the end of the brilliant happy podcast turns out all of mixed materials about wife beating. Very much not the case.
it's about diesel economy. It does encapsulate what we're about. We're a team. We both make mistakes, and we both work differently. And that's how that's how we're moving forward.
Thanks, Mick.
My pleasure, mate.
So that was Mickey. A really lovely interview there with an incredibly decent man. And if you haven't seen his stuff, do try and see him live. He's just an absolutely storming comic. I think To have been on that journey and gone through the crazy nights out and the performing drunk and the real just kind of going for it, hardcore journeyman, hell for leather road act, and then a festival act. And he just can just tear the roof off a tent. I've seen him in Adelaide before, just demolish it. And then to come out of that and still hold on to all of that ability, but also be not smoking or drinking or taking any tablets, and just be running marathons and being an incredible dude. What an inspiration, and a brilliant, brilliant, very funny man. Thank you. That's all for now. Next week, Alfie Brown, very inspiring in a completely different way. So Alfie's coming up. Look forward to that. I've been Stuart Goldsmith. This show has been co-produced by Nathan Wood, and that's all for now. We'll speak to you soon. I keep saying we. Like, Nathan won't speak to you soon. He's not allowed to speak. Thanks. I'll speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
This is Nathan. I don't think Stu normally listens this far.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.